Hello and welcome to Pillars of Wealth Creation, where we talk about creating financial success with a special focus on business and real estate. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. Now, let's get to it. Hey, are you looking to expand and grow your business? Are you looking for that edge, that next step up, that paradigm shift? Well, one of the best ways to get you there is through a mentor or a coach. And today's sponsor, Trevor McGregor, he is the man. He's going to get you to be laser focused, to get you onto that next level. And I know from experience dealing with Trevor, he is a master coach, peak performance coach, well over 10,000 coaching hours through clients all over the world. And he helps you achieve better health, more wealth and freedom and contribution than you ever thought possible. Have that coach that holds your feet to the fire. Go on to Trevor's website, coachwithtrevor.com. Again, it's coachwithtrevor.com. And there you can get a free strategy session with Trevor. And you can decide if he's the right fit for you and you're the right fit for him. Again, it's coachwithtrevor.com. You will not be disappointed. Hello and welcome to Pillars of Wealth Creation. And we are with another Hump Day Hustle. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer, and with me, as always, is John Stiles. John, how are we doing today?
Doing great. It's a good day to be alive.
Absolutely. Every day is a great day to be alive. So, John, today we're going to talk about a couple things. First, we're going to start out with, I got an interesting deal going on. I got an 84-unit building that I'm supposed to be closing on, actually, today. Okay. And it's not closing. Because we had our environmental phase one study done and the report came in, we found out that there is slight amount of lead in the water, just a little bit higher than EPA standards. We have 22 parts per billion of lead in the water. They tested a couple times. The first time it came in as they're being lead in. Then they ran the fixture for a couple minutes and then tested again. There was no lead or low lead. So that failed. Now we have to do an extensive test. So now they're going to be testing 23 locations on the property, and they're going to send it out to a lab to make sure the test results, you know, are completely accurate. And then from there, if it comes back bad results, we're going to have to make necessary corrections. We're going to have to figure out, you know, what is lead? Is it just the solder joints? Because this building was built in 1970, so they used to solder with lead. So is it just the solder joints? Is there lead coming in from the street, from the city? So that could be just as little as, you know, maybe like a $10,000, $15,000 job, which is still a lot. Do we have to replace all the faucets? What, you know, so we're going to have to figure that out if it does come back. So that could take, you know, quite a bit of time and effort. But one thing I wanted to point out is I was talking to one of my investor friends about this, somebody who buys multifamily and stuff. And I kind of mentioned it to him and like, man, you know, it's really looking forward to closing and my investors are going to be bummed that we're not closing. And he goes, well, you know what? If I was investing in the deal, I'd be so happy that I was investing with you, because he said, I never would have thought about doing a phase one report. It wasn't required in this case, but I wanted to do it because I knew as a Fannie Mae, if I got Fannie Mae financing, it'd be required. So he's like, I never would have done a phase one. And now you did this phase one and protected yourself. And now you protected your investors. So I'm sure they're extremely happy about it. And I thought, well, yeah, boy, I mean, you're right. I was kind of bummed, you know, going, geez, you know, this is my investors are going to be, you know, upset. And it's like, he's like, no, your investors are going to be happy that you know, you protected their investment. So,
yeah. For those people that have only been involved in residential, this whole thing, phase one, is probably a foreign topic to them. I even asked an inspector this past week, do you do phase one inspections? And he said, yes. And then after talking to him further, he actually had no idea what a phase one was. And he thought I was talking about something else. So maybe talk for a minute. What is involved with the phase one inspection?
Yeah, you know, I don't know everything that they do, but they basically, they're testing for environmental hazards. They're also researching that location and making sure that there was nothing hazardous that happened near your location. So if there was a former laundromat, former gas station, former really anything, that chemical plant or anything like that.
Dry cleaners is a big one I've
heard. Yeah. So anything like that, that was, you know, that was around, they're going to say, well, this was close by. We need to potentially test the soil. They're going to test your water. They're going to look for, you know, major lead or lead that could be, you know, on the walls, on the windows, all that kind of stuff, asbestos, really anything that could be environmentally hazardous. They're not going to do phase one is the basic test, right? Then there's the phase two and phase three. So if you find something, then we go to phase two. So if they found that there was a dry cleaner right next door, they might do a phase two. And again, I'm not an expert, so to always for sure talk to a true environmental inspector to get the full story on it. But yeah, you're essentially testing for environmental hazards that could affect your tenants, that could affect your sale, that could affect your financing, all that kind of stuff. So this could, you know, you want to, here's the danger. If I would have just went ahead with the sale, didn't get the environmental phase one. Now I take over a building. Well, what happens if a kid gets sick? And then they test the water, you know, a nonprofit or agency or whatever, test the water and they find out that there's lead in the lines. And whether that not that kid got sick on my property, they're going to point the finger at me because I'm the greedy landlord, right? So they're going to point, it's true. They're going to point the finger at me and say, it's my problem. Now I have potential litigation. I've got to fix the problem myself. And so that could be a massive undertaking right there. I mean, the lawsuits alone, how many tenants have been in that property over the last, you know, 5-10 years? How many are currently living there? It's an 84 unit building. That's a lot of potential lawsuits going on, and it could be a huge payout. And now insurance would cover a lot of that, but still, I mean, talk about, you know, the pain and, you know, whether or not I get sued, it's still, you don't want your tenants living in an environment where they're potentially getting sick. Right. And so you want to make sure they're being taken care of. So whether you're worried about the money or not, it's about the well-being of your tenants as well. So.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So anyways, good lesson. I learned, you know, due diligence is really important. Yeah. And you know, I think as I do more deals, it's just going to be more and more due diligence and trying to make sure you're getting every little last thing. Of course, you can always miss something, but the more you dig, the better chance you are at getting to everything. So, yeah.
You kind of got lucky that you found this before you closed, seeing that you're supposed to close today, but shouldn't.
Well, the environmental would have been done. We weren't closing without the environmental.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, why didn't you get the phase one earlier?
Yeah, I should have. The phase one should have been done earlier. Okay. But you know, I didn't, like I said, I wasn't planning on doing it, and I just decided, you know, it was, I should do it. Okay. Because there was no hazards nearby. There was no gas station close by. There was never a gas station close by. All the properties around anywhere close are all 1970s built, you know, they're all built around the same time. So it's not like a gas station was knocked down so there was nothing there. It was all farm field before these buildings were built. So I thought, man, there's nothing to worry about. But, you know, luckily we got it. So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's great.
Sorry for those who are watching on YouTube. I just got done with a 5-mile run, so I'm all sweaty and nasty. So that's why I'm glistening.
Well, listen, Todd, if people are watching this channel and this listening to your podcast, and they're thinking to themselves, maybe they're thinking about getting into real estate, but haven't done it quite yet and haven't really chosen a route. You know, there's active ways to be involved in investing, and then there's more passive ways. I thought it would be good to just talk briefly about what are some pros and cons between the two.
Yeah, John, and that, you know, that's that goes with business as well. I think Robert Kiyosaki. A lot of people are rich dad, poor dad people. They love those books, whether you like them or not. He makes some pretty good points, and he talks about, you know, always owning a business as well. And so there, this could be in business and in real estate, being passive or being active. You know, what are the pros and cons? And I think they relate pretty well with each other. I'm passive in several businesses. I have been investing in some startups and other companies. So, same thing goes with that. So, but yeah, what are the pros and cons? I've been getting that question a lot from people, and there's the passive that we're going to invest in a syndication. So I've got an apartment building and I bring in other investors, and they're limited partners. They're not making the day-to-day decisions, but they're getting a good return on their investment. And then there's, you know, you go out, you've got your own money and you buy a single family, you maybe buy a fourplex. Maybe you can take down a 10 unit or a 20 unit, depending on how much capital you have to deploy. Really much beyond, I think, you know, that 30, 40 units. Most people are at least partnering with others with money to pool money, or doing a full-blown syndication, especially when you're getting into coming up with $1 million, $2 million, $3 million dollar down payment. So I guess pros that I can think of on being active is, if you want to learn, if that's your goal, is to be part of that business, you want to learn how to operate the business, you want to have full control over it, that's definitely good with active. You have to. The only way to buy a single family, even up to a 6, 7, 8, 10 unit, is to be pretty active in the whole thing from start to finish. You have to find the property, you have to do all that. So that would be a pro, and I think also could be a con, depending on what you're trying to do, right? So it really does come down to goals as well.
Do you think that probably somebody's current financial situation has a lot to do with whether or not they're active or passive? I know when I began to invest in real estate, you know, I didn't have much money. So I didn't have money to be passive in somebody else's deal. So the only way for me to get in that I knew of was to be actively involved in a specific property.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if you don't have, you know, $50,000, you're not going to be able to invest in most people's passive syndications. Also, if you're not accredited, a lot of investors don't take, a lot of sponsors don't take non-accredited people. We take some, but you have to be sophisticated. So it's, you know, it's a hurdle to get through. So yeah, for sure. It's, I guess, your barrier to entry, as far as monetary basis, for sure. Being active, you can get in a lot cheaper. The other thing I think with active is you do have the possibility, now this is being very active, but you have the possibility of being able to buy a property that is very distressed with your capital, renovating it, and then getting tenants in there and refinancing it right away, bringing back most of your capital, if not all of it, and sometimes depending on how much value you added. And then you can continue to do that again, building a portfolio that way. Now, that's difficult, especially in a competitive market like today, but that is a way to do that. I would say the other thing is you have more control, right? I mean, you can decide when to buy, what it looks like, what neighborhood exactly, what tenants to put in there, all that kind of stuff. You can also decide when to sell it. You can decide that you want to paint it hot pink or, you know, gray, all that kind of stuff. You decide what you want to do to it. So that's definitely a pro if you like that approach. I think a con with kind of piggybacking off of that is you have to decide what color to paint it. You have to decide how to pick the tenants. You have to decide when to evict tenants. You have to figure out eviction laws and tenant landlord laws. Unless you're going to hire third party management, of course, then you can hand some of that off to, but you have to make a lot of those decisions. Mm-hmm. So with passive, I think some advantages of that is you are dealing with what should be an experienced sponsor, right? And the experienced sponsor is going to have a business that's already up and running, the business that's operating has got a proven track record. So you're going to have the teams in place. They're going to have the systems in place. They're going to be able to get, you know, probably a lot better property because they've got the relationships built with the brokers and so on. They can get the contract work done for cheaper than, you know, most, especially if they're buying large property. And then the other thing is we can buy large property because we're putting a lot of people into that deal. So we're raising $1, $2, $3, $5 million to buy a lot bigger building. So now we can buy a 200 unit building, which comes with a lot of efficiencies. Think about it. You know, I met with a guy who had 700 units, bought a 700 unit complex. Okay. Well, with that 700 unit complex, he spent, I think I talked a little bit about this last week. He spent $1 million on all the extra bells and whistles. So he spent $1 million on, you know, volleyball courts and weight rooms and all kinds of toys, a pool, all that kind of stuff. Well, when you break that down, he spent just over $1,000 a unit on that, all that stuff. But think if you're going to put a pool and a weight room and a volleyball court and barbecue grills and, you know, he had 100 other things in there, a dog park in your 4 unit.
Yeah.
You know,
there's no money for that.
Right. Let's just say you spend $50,000 on a 4 unit. Well, geez, you spent over 10 grand a unit just to get even not even close to what the same amenities are in that 700 unit building. So it's that size allows you to do a lot more on a per unit basis. And then you've got more efficiencies with the management, with the maintenance. You don't have to be going there because you've got on-site people watching the building all the time. I still own a bunch of single families, and this is a perfect example. So I got a bunch of single families, and I had some contractors that came in from out of town. We had a bunch of storm damage, and they were living in one of my properties. They're paying me 1.5 times the rent to do a short-term lease, which was great, but they hadn't paid December rent yet. And today is December 8th. So yesterday, December 7th, they hadn't paid the rent, and I hadn't heard from the main contractor about rent. We'd been sending him, we send notices right away when we're in rent's not paid, and he hasn't responded. So I sent my maintenance guy out there, checked, nobody's living there. Doors were unlocked, opened the door up, heat's off. It's 36 degrees inside the house.
No,
you know, luckily the pipes hadn't frozen because it's not that cold. But if this was mid-January and it was, you know, 20 below out, which we're in Minnesota, so that happens. If it was 20 below for a week, those pipes would have been frozen. I would have had, you know, major, major damage.
Yeah.
So that you can't, the efficiency is just not there. I can't send somebody to that property every single day to look.
Yeah.
But with a big building, we can. You know, we have people on site that would have been found out right away. So, yep. Yeah. So that's definitely, I think the efficiency is really huge with, you know, the passive type investment. But you also have to rely on the company, right? So you have to put trust in the sponsor. You have to make sure they're the right person to do that job. Because if they're not, things can still go wrong, and plenty of things can. So,
yeah.
What else? What do you think? Pros and cons of passive versus active. I know you're more on the active side, so
I am more on the active side. But you know, it depends. One other factor is how much time you have. So if somebody is a very successful doctor or, you know, some other career where that's taking the majority of the time, and they don't have, they're not worried about the financial barrier of entry. And they've seen that real estate can be a great tool to grow their money more than their savings account. You know, then that's probably a good passive, or investing passively is probably a really good option for that type of person.
Yeah.
So it, you know, time and money is a huge, are huge factors in your decision. So.
Yeah. Personally, with my experience with owning, you know, 50-ish 1-4 unit properties, those are a lot less efficient and more hands-on. In order to make the profits you intend to make, you have to be more hands-on. It's just to me, it's a proven fact. At least that's in my experience. If we just push these to the side and don't pay any attention to them, we're going to have poor results. And even when we are very hands-on, we still oftentimes don't have as good a results as what we think we should have, because, you know, one single tenant on a single family house, if they move out, they're going to cost you a whole year worth of income. I just had a move out, you know, and this new property. So I've got two move outs on single families. But one of my move outs, the lady lived there for 7-8 years, and now she just moved out. We're renovating the property. We're going to spend about $5,000 on the renovation. It's just paint and, you know, some flooring and minor stuff. We had to replace one appliance. Mm-hmm. This is a full month of vacancy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's $1,500 worth of rent, and that's $5,000 worth of repairs. I'm at $6,500. That's my whole 1 year worth of income on that property. So my net income in 2018 or 2017, I guess we're still in 2017, wiped completely out, gone. So.
Well, yeah, but you know, you have to start there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Especially if you're in a position like how I started, I had time, I had a desire to learn the trade, I even enjoyed getting my hands dirty a few times. You know, I mentioned in our previous show that, you know, I was doing some of the turnover work. I did hire a painter. I did hire a cleaner. I even hired an electrician because there were some issues with that. But then some of the just minor things, replacing blinds and other things like that, you know, I got in there to do that. And that just helps me to get to know my property better too, and kind of, when you spend more time there, you can kind of see, do I enjoy being here? Will my tenants enjoy being here? What are things that I can do to make this property better? And that can result in better rents going forward.
Well, yeah. And that speaks to personality, right? I mean, if you hate doing that every day, why put yourself through it? Right. If like you despise going to your property and talking to your tenants and stuff like that, and you despise looking for properties and making offers and negotiating, well, why spend any time doing that? But it's not worth it. I hear so many people that, you know, they've got the tenants' trash and toilet stories, and it's like, that's not the only way to invest in real estate. You can be passive or you can be active, and you got to decide what fits for you, right?
Yeah. Yes. At the same time, I mean, a lot of those stories come from finding bad tenants or allowing them to control
the situation. Step all over you, right?
Yeah. So that can be a personality thing too, whether or not, I mean, managing a property is one aspect of investing, or if you have a passive a rental property. So if you're not good at that one piece, you know, maybe hire a manager.
Yep.
If you're not good at the repairs, make sure you're hiring that out, you know.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. As long as you buy the right investment and have enough profit margins set up so you can do that. And that's what I would suggest. Anybody who's buying a especially a single family or 1-4 unit building, you got to make sure that you really think about what your repairs are going to be and then what's your replacement reserve. I see it a lot of times just on Bigger Pockets the other day, somebody put a deal up that they're doing and, you know, this is their net income, this is their expenses. And I'm going, there's no possible way you're going to get by with those expenses. There's just no way. And this was, I think this was like a 8-unit building or something like that. And it's like, boy, I mean, you're just not going to do it. You're expecting your repairs to only, you know, take up about 6% of the gross revenue, and you don't have a replacement reserve. And it's just like, this is how you're going to get hurt, is by assuming you're making so much money on this deal, and all of a sudden this deal's really a dog in the end. So
this might be a little too detailed for this specific conversation, but do you have specific percentages on your gross income for repairs and reserves?
You know, it can vary. Yeah. I mean, for a larger multifamily, it's going to be less per unit. It's going to be like that 250 to 300 a unit. Depends on the age too. You know, if we got a newer building, it might be less. If we got an older building, it's going to be more. For a single family, I like to use $100 a month for repairs, and I like to use $150 a month for a replacement reserve. So I'm using a total of 250. And that might be slim depending on the house you're buying. If you're buying a newly renovated house, which is what I buy junky houses, or used to buy junky houses and then fix them up. So they are newly renovated. So I got a new furnace, I got a new water heater, I got a new roof, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm putting $150 away in a reserve account because I know stuff's going to happen eventually. And I put $100 aside per month for repairs.
So going off of that, that single family that you mentioned, you said she was in there for about 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had a big reserve account. So
did you? Okay.
Yeah.
$150 a month times 12 months is $1,800 a year times, let's see, I guess 1800 times, we'll give it 7 years. Okay. That's 12,600. So really your net income for this year shouldn't be.
Well, right, right. but I'm still continuing to put that 150 away, you know.
Yep.
Because other stuff's going to happen too, right?
Yeah,
so the roof eventually is going to go bad.
Sure.
Furnace eventually is going to go out, all that kind of stuff. So
so those reserves can't be all for just a minor turnover. It's got to be for the larger.
Yeah, it's got to still be for the larger items. You know, the good thing is I'm conservative. So when I'm looking at it, I'm in the 7 years, quite frankly, that property has performed really well in the 7 years. She had an agency that was helping. And the agency would come and do repairs.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't spend, I don't think, a dollar on repairs in that property. My maintenance people didn't even know I had that property. So we didn't spend any money on it. So I'm budgeting $100 a month on that property. I didn't spend, I honestly don't think I spent a dollar. So there's another 7,000, you know, not 7,000, more than that. There's a lot of money saved up in that as well.
Okay.
So yeah,
do you forcibly like transfer the money to a different account so it's set aside as a reserve account?
I keep it in each individual account.
Okay.
So I have that property has its own account, mm-hmm. and it always continues. So every single month we leave minimum 150 in there for reserves, 100 for repairs. If we spend the repairs, then that obviously comes out. But mm-hmm. if we don't spend, let's say, we'll keep 100 in there, and let's say we spend 50, we still will leave the other 50 in that account.
Yeah.
So, 'cause the next month might be 150.
Yep.
So we might need that. So,
yeah. Well, we're getting off into some specifics here.
We're getting into the weeds.
So any other pros and cons to passive investing versus active investing?
You know, I think that's, I think we covered a lot of them. I'm sure there's plenty of others that you can come up with, but it really depends on the person and what your true goals are. You know, if you want to get into real estate as a more active person, I actually think passively investing can still be a good way depending on how you do it. You can still learn what's your goal? Is your goal to get to multifamily or commercial buildings? Is your goal to actually be a syndicator? If that's your goal in the future, then actually teaming up with the syndication company or teaming up with a commercial person or whatever that is a great way to do it. So if you can come into it a little more active, that's better for sure. So if maybe if you have $50,000 that you want to invest, but you also say, hey, with that 50 grand, I want to invest, but I want to be a little more active, even if you don't take any extra profit, even if you just, you know, are a little more active, that's going to help you learn as well. I'm not saying that's the only way to do it. That's just an option to do it.
Yeah.
So looking back, you know, from where, how many years I've been doing this, I wish I would have done that more. I wish I would have taken some of my profits and invested with some experienced apartment buyers. I think it would have helped me. And plus it would have helped me make money in the interim. But when I wasn't ready to invest in a 200 unit apartment building myself, if I would have been able to put $50,000 or $100,000 into one of those deals, not only could I make, you know, 20% return on my investment or close to that, but I could also learn along the way and grow and figure out the mistakes that they make and figure out the systems that they have in place and all that kind of stuff a lot quicker than what I learned. So I think it would have helped me along the way as well. And not saying that's for everyone, but I think that would have been, I wish I would have done it like that a little bit more. You know, but it is what it is. I'm on the track where I'm at and, you know, things are going well right now. So it's,
yeah,
you know.
You know, if somebody's in that situation where they have some money to invest, when they either look for a business partner or a syndication to work with, mm-hmm. To be more passive, you know, that's creating a partnership. And we've heard a lot of horror stories kind of about partnerships maybe not ending well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, sure. People get different ideas and then they're up because maybe they should have been active and controlling the situation, but they're not, they're passive. So I don't know, just any tips for setting up partnerships and that type of thing. Of course, no legal advice, but
right. No legal advice, but yeah, I've got a ton of tips. I mean, I had a partnership and you know, we ended up splitting up after years of being in partner as a partnership, and things were a little difficult because we didn't set it up right in the beginning. So I think setting up your exit, making sure everything's set up legally and properly. So when we do our syndications, we go through a securities attorney. We set everything up properly. We've got an operating agreement. We've got our private placement memorandum. We've got our meeting minutes, all that kind of stuff. And we have a process. We have a full blown business plan that we hand to our investors. This is what you can expect. And so they know what to expect going into it. And then, of course, you have to have that trust. I mean, they're, quite frankly, there's no, you can have as much paperwork as you want, but if you don't have trust, it's still going to be unsuccessful, right? So you have to be working with ethical people and understand who you're working with first and foremost. I mean, that to me is the most important part. But now if you're not doing a syndication, you know, it's still kind of the same thing. You don't have to have a private placement memorandum and some of the other stuff, but you still should have that operating agreement. You still should have a full-blown business plan. You know, what do we expect? What is John doing and what is Todd doing? What are we doing in this business to make this thing successful? Are you the numbers guy and am I the relationship guy or vice versa? And, you know, what are our job roles? I think setting up job roles is really important. And not that you can't crisscross and kind of also be doing a little bit of what I do and me doing a little bit of what you do, but we should have truly clear description and goals and then always be working to improving that relationship as well. I talked with a company, it's three partners, and this will be actually on a podcast in another month that will air, recorded them. But it was really intriguing because they talked about, you know, how they would argue with each other and you know, they had, it just, I think kind of what their point was is, look, things weren't going that great. I mean, I don't think it was like, hey, we're going to split this partnership up, but it wasn't going that great. And then they started reflecting within each other. Not instead of pointing the finger at each other, they're reflecting within and going, now what can I actually do to improve this business? So having a partner like that, that's willing to reflect upon themselves versus always pointing the finger or always saying, if you only did this, we would be better. Versus if I did this, we would be better. I think that's the type of partner you need to be looking for.
Yeah. Well, I think most business relationships do end at some time, right? Unless you're building this gigantic corporation that's going to last for generations. Most of our partnerships in real estate are going to be short-term, meaning, 5, 10, 15 years.
Yeah, yeah. Like well, and even a lot of the big corporations you look, they've had changeover at the top.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
So like we were saying, it's really good to kind of plan for the end, right, from the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you set the expectations, and then there's no arguing about it later when you kind of get emotional because something happened.
Yep.
So.
Yep. For sure. Anything else, John? What do you got that you want to cover? Anything you want to cover?
Not too much. Just kind of I'm on the grind of just trying to get my calls in and trying to finish out this year well, staying in touch with my database. And, I do have, I have an event coming up, which you should come to, by the way. You've probably heard of the Feed My Starving Children.
Oh yeah. I love that. I love that organization.
Yeah. So, and for those maybe nationally that might not know this, so they pack up food and they have volunteers to actually do the food packing.
Yeah.
And then they send them overseas to obviously impoverished places where kids could use the meals. So a bunch of us are going to get together on the 29th. Kids will be off school for the break. And just a good opportunity to get out and give back a little bit. So
awesome. Well, that's fantastic. I'll look and see what my schedule is like. I love that organization. I love doing, we've packed several times, my family, my daughter, son and wife and I packed last year, and we've done it several times. So we love doing it. One thing I wanted to cover is I've gotten this question a lot, I think in the last, week or so is how do I get started?
Okay.
And we won't spend too much time because I think this is getting a little long right now, but people keep on asking me, how do I get started? Where do I go? And I think one of the big things is, get off your thumbs and do something. It's analysis paralysis. It's a fear of actually pulling the trigger and getting a deal done. You eventually have to do a deal. Otherwise you're not a real estate investor if you're not investing.
Yeah.
Right. So whether it's, I'm going to invest with the syndication company passively just to get involved in real estate, or whether it's, I'm going to go out and buy my first single family house. You got to do it. And if you've been studying it, you've been learning about it. Somebody asked me recently, they've been on BiggerPockets. They've been listening to podcasts. They've been, learning all this kind of stuff, reading books and blah, blah, blah. Been learning about it forever, but they're not investing. Well, what good does that do for you? You got to get off your butt and you have to buy something. You have to do it. If you're not going to do it, stop learning about it. Right. And I don't mean to like be cruel to the people that aren't doing it, but honestly, you're going to burn out. If you don't do a deal, eventually you're just going to burn out and you're never going to do a deal. And it might be 5 years and all of a sudden you're going, I haven't done a deal yet, and you're just going to burn out. You're going to not like real estate. You're going to not like business or whatever you're trying to invest in. So eventually you've got to actually do the deal. So I would challenge anybody that's listening here that hasn't done a deal, or maybe it's been a long time since you've done a deal, You need to do a deal within the next 6 months. Whether you have money or not, you need to figure out a way to do a deal. You need to do seller financing. You need to find partners. You need to, you need to do a deal. You need to find a deal for an investor that has money and partner with them. Instead of wholesaling that thing and taking a $15,000, $20,000, $50,000 fee, whatever that might be, partner with them. Find them the deal, and this is the deal. You get this deal for the price I found it for, but I want 20%. I want 30%. I want whatever it is. Negotiate that part of it. And so now you're part of that deal instead of just, you know, reading about it.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. A lot of that education obviously is important.
It's important, definitely.
You don't
definitely.
Know anything. You can't, you know, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
So definitely keep learning, keep listening to the podcasts, keep reading. And maybe one other thing is to find one other person in your market who is active as an investor and learn from them. Meet, buy them lunch and, you know, see what they need and see how you can plug into that.
Yeah. I think more than just one, John, I think, I mean, you're right. You're spot on though. I mean, continue your education. Always keep on learning. That's for sure. I look at my bookshelf. I've got, you know, 100 books up there on business and real estate and all kinds of stuff. And I read them. I read a book, you know, I read in a book every single day. So I'm always learning. I listen to, I think on my phone, I've got probably 7-8 different podcasts that I listen to. And I plug into other podcasts that people refer to me all the time. So I've got audio books that I listen to. So I'm always learning for sure. You got to do that. Mm-hmm. And then like you said, meet with one investor today, but then meet with another investor next week and another investor. If you can meet with, you know, one investor every week or two, you're going to build relationships. And I know, John, that's something you do. You meet with other investors. You mentioned before the show, you just met with an investor this week. You meet with investors, you talk with them, you're part of organizations and groups, and you're learning from other people. And that's what's going to actually bring you deals. And that's what's going to give you opportunities to continue to grow and to get into deals and explode your business. So for sure.
Yep. Also, I mean, find a local real estate agent and get out there to look at properties. I mean, yes, you can do your own marketing, your own prospecting, but also consider just work with a local agent. They'll send you deals. They'll take you to properties. So,
If you haven't bought a deal and you've been just reading books and listening to podcasts and stuff like that, the least that you can do for yourself is get a deal sent to you and analyze that deal.
Yeah.
And then the next step is make an offer on a deal. And then the next step is actually to do something. But you've got to start doing it and get creative if you need to be creative or whatever you need to do. So, So that's my suggestion for people who say, how do I get started? Get started. Do it. Stop thinking about it. So
very good.
All right, John. Well, I appreciate you joining me for
Hump Day House.
Yeah, absolutely. And, make every day a Saturday, man.
Sounds good. You too.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Are you having a hard time finding great investment properties? Unfortunately, the best deals are rarely found locally. Successful investing begins with the right properties in the right markets. Norada Real Estate provides everything you need to invest in the best deals across the U.S. Our simple, proven system will help you create real wealth and passive monthly cash flow. Get your free copy of the Ultimate Guide to Passive Real Estate Investing at noradarealestate.com/guide. That's NORADA realestate.com/guide.